or the reassignments of senators who seek new committee posts. That steering committee consists in a very large measure of powerful Southern Democrats who have had long service in the Senate. Again, while they do not necessarily represent the of the steering committee, they represent a sufficient number, plus their years of experience and influence as committee chairman, so as to have their recommendation
that this is working properly, just to record these final reflections. This is just to continue on that point about the similarity between Jensen and Humphrey in one respect. But I think that Humphrey really got carried away during that early period there in the vice presidential years was on that. But the whole idea that we would make the kind of commitment to Southeast Asia, an area, thousands of miles away, had nothing in common with the United States. Come on, we would make the kind of commitment that we made to Western Europe, the part of the world from which we Americans all came. That was the most absurd part of the whole Johnson policy, in my view, period. And that's why when Humphrey, during that early period in 66, was mouthing that nonsense, it seems to me he did himself an awful lot of harm, period. This was the part of the whole Pax Americana that was most dubious. This was the element of American imperialism that was most unrealistic, period. It wasn't just a question, according to Johnson and his spokesman at that time. It wasn't just a question of defeating a specific military foe like the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese. No, our mission there was much grander.
It is soon circles about human nature and society. Just about true. Not to mention assumptions that have no validity whatsoever when applied to societies like those in Southeast Asia. It assumed that Americans could in fact do these things, regardless of what happened on the ground among the people living there. And that, of course, was the final overreaching. In the end, we had to learn that there were certain things that we couldn't do. Indeed, there are certain things that no imperial power can do. Humphrey's views on some of that were quite mixed, Buried. In a way, it has been argued and can be argued, the whole Wilsonian strain in American history came out once again. Vietnam, Buried, I think it's Pat Moynihan who's argued it was a misinterpretation of Wilsonianism, a misguided view of Wilsonianism. There's no doubt about it. It wasn't just defeating another military foe. It was really exporting a particular vision of America, a particular recipe made in America to another society, period. I guess in that regard, Humphrey was really closer to Lyndon Johnson than he was to George Ball, even though in the beginning, at least, his views and Ball's views on the wisdom of an American military commitment were the same, period. And I think he always, throughout the 4 years, continued to have some sympathy for Ball's position, even though he defended the president's policy. Ball's position, of course, was essentially that Vietnam really wasn't very important in terms of American strategic interests. He had a view of international politics that, in some respects, despite his later criticisms of Kissinger, was similar to Kissinger in many ways, period. He didn't believe in transforming societies, or other than Johnson, or making the world safe for democracy, a la Woodrow Wilson, period. He believed in balancing power. His judgment, power in Asia meant Japan above all, to a lesser extent China, and far, far down the list, India. But these peninsular appendages in the Indochina Sea were relatively unimportant. Important was Europe, Western Hemisphere, and Japan. Therefore, we shouldn't mess around with diversions. This idea of bringing the Great Society to Asia, or to any place, for that matter, was wholly alien to Ball's approach to international politics. Paragraph. Another thing I think that was fairly obvious that distressed Humphrey a great deal and added to his unhappiness, and he was a deeply unhappy man throughout those years, was the fact that he saw what the whole involvement was doing to American society, period. He used to get very angry at those students who would harass him on university campuses. And of course, some of them behaved outrageously by any civilized standard. But Humphrey was, despite his outrage at times, he was sensitive enough and intelligent enough to know that this issue was tearing the country apart, and it wasn't just among radical students. Sooner or later, he saw its effect on the labor movement, a good part of it, university faculties, many of which had been heavily involved in strong anti-communist movements decades after World War II. He later would see it, of course, in church groups and business groups, other professional groups. spirit. I think it it added to the burden he carried. It added to his anxiety to see what was happening to the United States spirit. And therefore, when Johnson did make the decision, March 31st, not to run, and with it, the decision not to get involved in Vietnam any further than we already had, to find some way of getting out, to come, I think there was no one in the country who was more relieved at that than Hubert Humphrey. He really had suffered a great deal over the Vietnam issue. It wasn't just that, you know, it hurt his political career. He just agonized over it. And it was a deep anguish and turmoil. I certainly had the impression by far the unhappiest period of his life, and he's never experienced anything like it since. And finally, I think from time to time he, you know, came to the conclusion that it was, in the end, the Vietnam issue more than anything else that cost him for presidency. It had American involvement in Vietnam developed in a different way or not taking place. Come on, one can't be sure that, you know, Johnson would have retired and Humphrey would have had kind of shot at the nomination that he did have. But still, I think that one of the gnawing things that stayed with him was the fact that in addition to all the other negative consequences of Vietnam, was the fact that it was a major element in denying him the number one prize that all national politicians in the United States seek, that is to say, the presidency. Why don't we stop there? I can see this really starts with the end of 1966 and into 1967 period. Although I'll make some comments on various things as we go along in 67, what strikes me as most significant in looking over my files for the year is that not much happened that year period. It's a pretty dead year in terms of significant things for Humphrey on the Vietnam side period. He did get involved in other issues, including Europe, through his European trip that April. Of course, he did go to Vietnam at the end of November that year for the inauguration of President Chu. I think I have something on that, although nothing terribly significant happened in Vietnam. Norman, I'm going to move now to 1967, with one exception. I came across a copy of an article from the Wall Street Journal dated April 20th, 1966, that I wasn't able to find earlier on, period. I did make some reference in my earlier comments to Humphrey's comments about the Great Society in Asia on the CBS broadcasting program with Severide, period. In the April 20th issue of the Wall Street Journal, Phil Jalin has a piece where he talks about this. I'll just make a couple quotations here, which Phil gives from Humphrey. Humphrey said, quote, and this is Jalin quoting directly from the transcript of that television broadcast, quote, I would never want anyone to underestimate the meaning of the Honolulu Conference or the Honolulu Declaration, period. If that is studied carefully, comma, I think it has as much significance for the future of Asia as the Atlantic Charter had for the future of Europe. When asked whether this was an articulation of a Johnson Doctrine for Asia, Humphrey replied, quote, yes, I think it was. I hadn't heard it put quite that way, but as you have said it, that would be as I would envisage it and see it. The Honolulu Declaration, he said, pledged the United States, quote, to defeat aggression, to defeat social misery, to build viable free institutions, and to achieve peace. These are great commitments, comma, he said. I think there is a tremendous opening here for realizing the dream of the great society in the great area of Asia, comma, not just here at home. And I regret that we haven't been able to dramatize it more, unquote. Then Erich Severide followed that statement with a question, quote, this is Severide, you seem to me to be saying that the Johnson Doctrine, if we may call it that, is proposing a relationship between this country and Asia, far away as it is, and sprawling and diverse as it is, comma, a relationship as fundamental, as long-standing, intimate, and possibly expensive as our historic association with Europe. Is it of this scale, of this magnitude? Unquote, Severide. Humphrey responded, I think so, unquote, Section Humphrey added, quote, Vietnam is almost like the first voyage of an explorer into a new land, The ship has almost been storm-tossed on the shore, but we are there, unquote, And then he added, quote, we are going to be in Asia for a long, long time, unquote. I mention this because this was used by Fulbright and others in the Senate, as well as people in the press, to embarrass Humphrey and the administration, It was used as an indication that the Johnson administration was really proposing not only a direct military intervention in Vietnam itself, but a sweeping commitment to Asia, far beyond anything the president had ever discussed with the public or with Congress, In some respects, this this series of statements got Humphrey into more trouble with some of the serious critics of Vietnam policy than anything else he ever said. Fulbright, for example, was especially hard on this statement, And among other statements, he mentioned in a speech in the Senate he made on July 22nd, quoting from Humphrey's April 19th CBS television interview, Fulbright concluded his statement, where he quoted Humphrey at length, saying, quote, it is ironic that at the same time that the vestiges of the Monroe Doctrine are being fitfully liquidated, the United States should be formulating a similar doctrine of preeminent American responsibility for Asia, One wonders whether the Asian doctrine will reap for the United States as rich a harvest of affection and democracy as has the Monroe Doctrine, One wonders whether China will accept American hegemony as gracefully as Cuba and the Dominican Republic have accepted it, And one wonders whether anyone ever thought of asking the Asians if they really want to join the Great Society, unquote. Moving on to 1967, as I said, there wasn't all that much that was of terribly great significance that happened, The policy in Vietnam that had been set really by July of 1965 remained set, If you have it available readily, you might want to take a look at the actual text as delivered of a speech Humphrey gave to the United Jewish Appeal on February 23rd, 1967, it's a wide-ranging speech, Humphrey is 100% for Johnson's policy, But he goes way beyond a text and shoots off his mouth about a lot of things, including how the communist leaders used a women's front organization, which cut up the generals with fine little razors. Yes, to this is a speech that's full of a certain amount of Humphrey hyperbole. Because he is so outspoken, I think it also kind of reflects what's on his mind. He says one part, he says, I hope that people don't believe Ho Chi Minh before they believe the President of the United States, the Vice President, Secretary of State. He said, why should I lie to you? I have no desire to lie to you. I know this is the most unpopular thing I can ever do. Quote, let me tell you, I've suffered more from this Vietnam War politically and personally than anything in my life. Unquote. Although, again, that's a bit of Humphrey hyperbole, it also reflects what Humphrey was saying privately at that time period. This was a period in which there was sufficient data available, accumulating all throughout 1967, indicating that the war really wasn't going so well, indicating that the bombing really wasn't having its effect, Humphrey became more and more pained and anguished, period. By the second half of the year, the dissenters within the government were marshaling their forces, and a number of them did get to high officials in the government, including Humphrey, period. Also, by this time, he had really lost many of his liberal friends, and this included people that he knew well, liked very much, was indebted to, and had supported him, period. It really hurt him a lot, all the more so because he was not and is not a callous man, and continued to feel these slights and rebuffs more than many political men do. As I said, the record in the calendar year 67 really doesn't reveal all that much of great significance. One thing you might try to draw Humphrey out on is the subject of the discussion that was going on within the U.S. government during calendar year 1967 on the Vietnam issue. There are a number of reliable published reports on this, including Henry Brandon's book. I think Clark Clifford and Harry McPherson also have covered this, period. There were a number of people in the government who, beginning in late 66 and continuing right on through 67 and up to March 31st, 68, when the president announced his intention not to run, who were attempting to convince the president really to change his policy, period. John McNaughton, who was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, was in many ways the leader in the Pentagon at that time, period. He came soon to be working closely with Nick Katzenbach in the State Department. Period, and Nick in turn had a number of people over there who worked closely with him, including Ben Reed and Tom Hughes. Period. This was after George Ball left the government, which, as I recall, was in early '67
or late 66. It was during this period that McNaughton, and after he died in a plane crash sometime in 67, later Paul Warnke, made quite a good deal of progress in convincing McNamara that the bombing strategy really wasn't working, and that the overall policy, which we by then pursued for almost 3 years since Johnson's accession to the second term, really wasn't working. Was full of reports that McNamara already had changed his view, that he'd become a secret dove. But I used to talk with Humphrey about this because I would hear from people in the State Department like Tom Hughes or Ben Reed, or from liberal journalists like Joe Kraft or Mary McGrory, or foreign journalists like Henry Brandon, that McNamara really had come to agree with McNaughton. He thought the whole thing had gone sour and was wrong, period. Humphrey always responded that he didn't know what McNamara's secret views were, but he did have considerable opportunity to hear his views as expressed to the president. Period. By the second half of 1967, Humphrey was attending a fair number of meetings that went beyond the formal meetings of the National Security Council. Therefore, I think it's accurate to say that he did sit in on some of the smaller sessions, occasionally, though not regularly, including those Tuesday luncheons, where the president met with Rusk and McNamara, Rostow, and Helms. Anyway, smaller sessions where Humphrey had a chance to hear McNamara present his views in a less formal body than the NSC, period. According to what Humphrey told me, he never in any way heard McNamara dissent from the president's views, period. Continued to say that the guy who always took on George Ball, or later Nick Katzenbach, and argued against their critiques of the prevailing policy was McNamara, period. The important thing here in terms of Humphrey is whether he, in fact, played any particular role or any significant role in this discussion that was going on, that became even more heated after the Tet Offensive of January 68, period. My own impression is that he didn't play any particular role, although by early 68, he did talk with Johnson about the overall issue, by which time Johnson was willing to talk with him. Perhaps even listen, period. But I think, in view of what's come out about those discussions that went on throughout 67 and blossomed really in early 68, it would be useful to know Humphrey's views on them and whether in his own judgment he had any particular impact or was very much involved in them at that time. In late November of 67, Humphrey went to Vietnam. For the inauguration of President Tu. And then afterward, in the first week of December, we went on to
Malaysia and Indonesia. And I can't remember, maybe we stopped in the Philippines on the way back. I'm not sure, but anyway. There was nothing terribly significant that happened on the trip. In many ways, the most important part of the trip was the Indonesian part, because he had some pretty strong substantive meetings there with the president and leading officials. This was a period in which our relations with Indonesia were blossoming, and Humphrey played a fairly important role in giving them some higher visibility. One of the most significant things I remember about the trip, coming in addition to dancing with Balinese dancing girls on the island of Bali, coming is the press corps that we had with us. It was much smaller than White House press corps that we had on the trip in February of 66. However, it included quite a number of people who had been stationed in Southeast Asia for some time and knew a lot about Vietnam and a lot about the area. This included Murray Frompson of CBS, Ron Ross of the Coles Publications, Kais Beach of the Chicago Daily News, and of course in Vietnam, Peter Arnett of AP. I remember having long conversations with this group, especially in Malaysia and Indonesia, and I think that Humphrey did have at least one session with them, although they represented hawks like Kais Beach and doves like Frompson and Ron Ross, they were all unanimous in saying things weren't going well and that our policy was failing, I remember it made a very strong impression on me, and I think that it made some impression on Humphrey. But I think the most important part of the trip, as I say, was not to Vietnam, but Indonesia. That's significant. I think that there were no very great policy issues that came up. I've now switched to early 1968. Humphrey was involved in a lot of the discussions between the beginning of 68 and March 31st, I don't recall that he had any particular role after the Tet Offensive in late January. He was definitely involved in a lot of the discussions that took place between the Tet Offensive and the President's Statement on March 31st, I think quite a number of those conversations were with the President himself, without any other people there or without many people there, Humphrey was very careful not to say much about those. So I don't find any written records in my files, He did tell me a certain amount about them, but was rather elliptical, He told me that he couldn't say much about them, and I think that's right, Otherwise Johnson would cut him out, But he did say that occasionally he would dictate home. He's recollections of what had happened. Period. Now, I don't know what the files show for that period. Would be worth knowing to what extent he really got deeply involved in the discussions that led up to the president's decision not to run. Period. I don't think it's necessary to go into the question of why the president decided that, but anyway, he did, and then the whole picture changed, period. The first several months after the president's announcement on March 31st were taken up with getting a campaign staff organized, period. It was really not until about June that we really got heavily into the substance of any foreign policy issues. But of course, Vietnam was uppermost in importance. Vietnam, of course, in 68, the most important issue was the effort of Humphrey and his people to reach some conclusion on what position he should take as he went into the pre-convention period, and then later on what position he should take afterward, period. I think as early as late June, we were talking about his doing some kind of a statement on Vietnam. But by early July, I more or less convinced him that he might make a statement either as a speech or as a submission to the platform committee, which would separate himself from Johnson's Vietnam policy, Britain. For example, in a memo which I wrote to him of July 13th, came back in his own handwriting on it, he says, Vietnam, I'm going to make a speech along the lines of the National Committee for Political Settlement. That, my understanding, my recollection is that was the group that Walter Ruther and Clark Kerr and Norman Cousins were involved in, period. He'd seen Cousins and Clark Kerr in California somewhere on this. Although I don't have the precise dates on all of this, I know that it was in early July that we met. In Washington to prepare the statement. What we had done was that I had prepared a draft on Vietnam, which I had sent to Sam Huntington as the chairman of the Vietnam Task Force, and another copy of it went to Doak Barnett as the chairman of the Asia Task Force, period. The two chairmen circulated this to their members, and it was agreed that we would all meet in Washington to refine this and come up with some kind of a statement which Humphrey would put out on Vietnam, period. My recollection is that we met sometime between July 5th and July 10th. We met at the AFL-CIO building, period. As I say, we had a text to start with that had been worked over a good bit. And we started early in the morning about 9 or 10 o'clock, and we worked for 5 or 6 hours on it through lunch. we came up with something that we were reasonably happy with. We then met the whole group, which included not only Spike Brzezinski and myself, and Sam Huntington and Doak Barnett, but lots of other people like Ed Reischauer and Lucien Pai of MIT, and Bob Scalapino of Berkeley, and I can't remember, not Charlie Yost, no, he wasn't there. Anyway, some other, quite a number of other Asian experts, too. And we met with Humphrey, and also sitting in were Willard Wirtz, and Orville Freeman, Bill Connell, John Stewart, Norman Sherman, I believe, maybe Bill Walsh. Can't remember whether Larry O'Brien was there or not. Anyway, we had quite a discussion statement and about an hour and a half, and concluded by Humphrey saying that he liked it, he wanted to make a few minor changes, and he said to me, John, would you work with Dave Ginsberg, and he's going to be working on the platform and so forth, and just make a few minor revisions on that along the line we've discussed, and we're prepared to get it out. And I remember Ed Reischauer said to him, he said, what are you going to do with it? And Humphrey said, well, first of all, I'm going to talk with the Secretary of State and the President about it. And Reischauer cut in and said, what are you going to talk to Russ for? You know what he'll say. And Humphrey was a bit taken aback because Reischauer is quite aggressive about it. And Humphrey said, well, at least, he said, maybe you're right about Rusk. He said, after all, I am the vice president, though, and I definitely have to talk to the president. And everyone, of course, nodded in agreement that he did have to talk to the president. So the way it was left as the meeting broke up was that it would be revised, and within a day or two, he would have a conversation with the president and then would put it out, either as a statement or as a speech. Paragraph. So we took it, and Ted Van Dyke and I worked it over a little bit, made a few minor changes, checked with Dave Ginsberg, who had been, you know, designated as the vice president's man on the platform committee, and we had a statement that everyone was happy about it, and took it into him, and next, about 24 hours later, and he had made an appointment with the president. And as I recall, the appointment was for 8 o'clock in the evening. About 10 to 8 that night, which would have been let's say about between the 10th and 15th of July, I think. About 10 days, Ted Van Dyke and I went in to see Humphrey, his office. We were quite aware that this was not an assignment he was looking forward to, and he was quite nervous about it. Anyway, he said to his boys, go on home, and if anything happens tonight that you need to know tonight, I'll call you. So we went home, and we didn't hear anything. So the next morning we went in, both of us, and Humphrey said something to the effect, well, he got over to the White House and there are a lot of people around. He never did really get a chance to talk with the president about it. So we said, okay, fine, we'd make another appointment since Johnson was in town and Humphrey was going to be in town. And well, it turned out for one reason or another, Humphrey didn't make another appointment. So, we kept at this for a few days, trying to get an appointment, that sort of thing, and one reason or another, never worked out.
Then by this time, a number of other people got into the act on the statement period. The statement definitely did separate Humphrey from Johnson's position in Vietnam and stake out an independent position period. There were those on his personal staff and also on his campaign staff who felt that this was a great mistake, comma, both from a substantive point of view on the merits of the issue and also from a political point of view. Therefore, the statement started going through various redrafts, and it went through a number. The one I have in my own file is draft number 9, dated July 30th, 1968. I think we had at least 11 before we quit redrafting. They'd go back and forth depending on who was in the act at the time. As was noted in the book by the British journalists, Ted Van Dyke kept a copy of the latest draft in his briefcase as they wandered around the country. He had one ready for release whenever Humphrey wanted to do it, but of course he never did. Actually, the write-up on this particular subject of this statement and how Humphrey wavered on Vietnam, the write-up in that book by Godfrey Hudson and Bruce Chester, An American Melodrama, The Campaign of 68, is quite good. It's not 100% accurate, but it's reasonably accurate. It might be useful to take a look at that. Anyway, for reasons that would later become known, Humphrey never did put out the statement before the convention opened. Paragraph. Therefore, we went into the convention in August without him having made the statement. Without him really having said anything on Vietnam that really separated himself from the president's position. Therefore, the focus of efforts to separate him from Vietnam, from the president's position in Vietnam, shifted to the convention itself, and there our platform people, namely, as I recall, Dave Ginsburg and Bill Welsh, bore the brunt of this labor. Ginsburg in particular, as I recall, met with the other people's representatives at the convention to try and work out some kind of a compromise in Vietnam. My recollection is that Ted Sorensen was acting for the Kennedy group there. Dick Goodwin was acting for McCarthy. And that Ginsburg at least thought he had some kind of an agreement on a compromise text, Anyway, it soon became clear that Johnson threw his operatives, whether Charlie Murphy or Hale Boggs or others. Was determined to head off any platform statement that really either disowned Johnson administration's policy or really separated Humphrey from Johnson. We would later learn that when Humphrey stopped at Johnson Ranch just a day or two before coming to Chicago, they had a discussion of the Vietnam issue at that time, although of course Humphrey wouldn't say much about this until later on, based on the
report I had about the conversation at the ranch, come, it was quite similar to the conversation that Humphrey, in fact, had had that evening in mid-July when he went over to the White House, period. Humphrey would later talk about what actually happened over at the White House that night and what happened down at the ranch, period. You want to get that directly from Humphrey because that's very, very important in answering the key question which everyone continues to raise, why Humphrey did what he did or failed to do what many anticipated he might do on the Vietnam issue during the summer and fall of 1968 in Vietnam, period. My understanding, which is partly secondhand and only partly based on Humphrey's direct comments, is that when he got to the White House that night in July, the president knew what was up, period. He was ready for him. That isn't so surprising, period. My recollection is the day after that meeting on the Hill with Humphrey, James Reston had a column where he reported on the gist of the conversation. I think he got to Ed Reischauer, as I recall. So anyway, Johnson knew what was coming up and was ready for Humphrey, period. According to the version I heard, Johnson threatened Humphrey, told him he'd go on TV and denounce him, told him he'd have the blood of his son-in-law on his hands, told him that John Connally controlled 400 votes at the convention with the Southern governors, and Humphrey would lose all those, and went on in that vein, period. My understanding is that he repeated a somewhat similar version with some variation of that theme when Humphrey stopped at the ranch. I think it was either a day before or 2 days before going to the Chicago convention, period. I remember Ted Van Dyke told me that they were coming from California going to Texas. I think they stayed over someplace in Austin, I guess, and Humphrey went to the ranch just with Bill Connell. Ted read some significance into that. Anyway, consistent with what is reported to have taken place there, Johnson's operatives thoroughly sabotaged any efforts to dissociate Humphrey from Johnson's policy at the convention itself, period. Important to get the exact byplay on that at the convention. I think John Stewart, Dave Ginsburg, and Bill Welsh give you a rundown for it. But the important thing to focus on here is why it was that Humphrey didn't choose to do in either July, pre-convention period, or at the convention itself in August, what he finally did in a somewhat modified way on September 30th through his Salt Lake City speech. I have not seen a good public on the record account of this, period. There have been some allusions to it, I think, in Henry Brandon's book and maybe others, period, but I don't think the record is clear on the kind of pressure that Humphrey came under from Johnson himself on this issue, period. Therefore, I think it's important that in Humphrey's memoirs, he tried to lay this out, period. It's especially important of the exact record of what transpired at those two meetings, the one in the White House and the one in Texas, and any other meetings that Humphrey may have had with Johnson on the same subject, period. Based on what I know about the subject, the threat of what Johnson might do was really very, very important. Period. Also, there have been suggestions that Humphrey was reluctant to do anything that would make Harriman's life more difficult at the Paris Peace Conference, Paris Peace Talks, period. I'm a little fuzzy on that, period. But my recollection is that that Harriman let Humphrey know that he had no particular problem with what he was trying to do. As I recall, he sent word through Ben Reed, I think, indicating this. Brit. On that one, I think I just asked Humphrey what he heard from Harriman. Brit. I don't recall anything that Harriman said, privately or otherwise, that indicated Humphrey should not separate himself in Vietnam. There were reports that was an important factor, but I don't know of any solid evidence to that effect. This dilemma, of course, extended right through the convention and afterward. You may remember that at the convention itself, we spent all day, the final day, writing that speech that Humphrey delivered. It was even worse than usual in terms of speech preparation. And we tried to get some language in there that implied, again, that Humphrey was moving away. And actually, as the speech was delivered, if you go back and read it, it definitely had some implications that Humphrey was moving away. It had a definite connotation that was different than the platform language itself. Johnson was reported to be quite unhappy with it. Of course, it got mixed up a little bit. The reaction to the Chicago police treatment of rioters and dissenters and so forth. Anyway, I remember that right after the convention, Humphrey started issuing conflicting statements. They went back and forth, both on the Vietnam issue and also on the police riot issue. But on the Vietnam issue, he went back and forth two or three times within a couple weeks after the convention. This caused a lot of consternation around the country. And it reflected once again the conflict within Humphrey's own organization, both his personal staff and his campaign organization, semicolon, reflected the conflict in Humphrey's own mind and what he should do. And it reflected the conflict within the Johnson government at that time, the kind of advice he was getting from cabinet people as well as the people more directly involved in the campaign. We've all been asked many times why it was that he vacillated so much
why it was. He took one position at one time and another position another time, period. I've thought about that a lot, period. First, it's always impressed me that very few people who were not directly involved fully understood the savage pressures that were on him, period. That's why I think it's so important to be sure that he does detail very accurately and completely exactly what Johnson said to him when he threatened him, as he supposedly did. Also, by the time the convention came around, August of 68, you know, Humphrey had been vice president for 3.5 years and more. Period. He was a much less self-confident man by then than he was when he entered the vice presidency, January of 1965. He'd always had some problem with self-confidence, hence his tendency to reflect the views of the last guy he talked to, come and also his tendency to seek the views of all kinds of people, come including those who had no qualification whatsoever to render judgments on an issue, period. He never was the kind of insecure man that Lyndon Johnson was. But at the same time, he never had that inner self-confidence in himself that John Kennedy had. Therefore, when you start with this fact and throw in over 3.5 years of not just the vice presidency and what it does to any man, but the vice presidency under Lyndon Johnson, it's not too difficult to understand why those tendencies toward insecurity and vacillation were greatly magnified by the end of his tenure as vice president. It's, of course, not very fruitful to speculate how Hubert Humphrey would have handled the same kind of problem, say, in the autumn of 1964. But my own judgment is that he was a much stronger man, much more self-confident man, in the autumn of 1964 than he was 4 years later. Paragraph. I think those of us who worked with him during those years oftentimes underestimated the kind of pressure he was under, period. I mean, I think of my own views on the Vietnam War and the stance I took vis-a-vis Humphrey on Vietnam right through the vice presidential years, period. I'd been very much opposed to involvement in Vietnam right from the beginning. Well before I joined his staff in October of 1962, and throughout the Senate and vice presidential years, period. Uh,
My reading was that our views in Vietnam during the two Senate years were very similar, even though our approach to Southeast Asia really stemmed from somewhat different premises, period. But after I became vice president, I continued to urge upon him a very limited involvement in Vietnam type issues, and secondly, to encourage him to try to separate himself as much as possible from the kind of policy that Lyndon Johnson eventually adopted in the first half of 1965 period. And I continued to grow increasingly frustrated that the more we got into the vice presidency, the more we got into 65 and 66, the more I lost on the issue period. I was quite aware that I was really arguing one side of the case, and Lyndon Johnson was arguing the other. So in effect, my principal disputant in the argument was not one of my colleagues on the staff, such as Bill Connell or Max Kampelman, who sincerely believed in another approach to the Vietnam issue, but was really Lyndon Johnson, period. Also, I think I did not fully appreciate, perhaps less so than some of my colleagues like John Stewart or Ted Van Dyke, that in urging Humphrey to desist on Vietnam or to take certain positions on Vietnam, I was in effect urging him to take risks in his own political career, which he felt, vis-a-vis Lyndon Johnson, he couldn't take, period. Humphrey always felt that was Lyndon, by naming him as the vice presidential candidate, who gave him another shot at the top job that he never would have gotten otherwise, and that it was Lyndon who could take it away from him, period. Therefore, regardless of what he thought about the merits of the issue, he always had in the back of his mind, and sometimes in the forefront of his mind, the fact that unless you were very, very careful on this issue, he could get in trouble with Johnson, Burritt. This continued to be an issue right through the vice presidential years and beyond the convention and into the campaign, Burritt. Once he got involved in the campaign after the convention, of course, the factor of the public opinion polls and the poor showing, great lead that Lyndon Nixon had, had a considerable effect, period. By that time, of course, you got the Vietnam issue mixed up with the Chicago Convention issue, and numerous others, period. However, it did continue to be a very, very important issue, especially with certain strata of political activists in the Democratic Party, people who not only voted, but worked, raised money, rang doorbells, formed a very important part of the organization in the campaign, period. For them, the Vietnam issue was in many cases a preeminent issue,
agitation discussion on that point period. Also, it was in that post-convention period that people like professional political leaders like Larry O'Brien did come to exert a considerable role in finally convincing Humphrey that he must separate himself more from the president's position. And of course, eventually this would lead to his Salt Lake City statement, period. Since I was not out at Salt Lake City, the account I can give it
secondhand, period.
There are people around like Ted Van Dyke and Bill Connell and others who were there and can give a direct account on that period. Larry O'Brien is also another one I'm sure you want to talk to on that period. The Salt Lake City thing is very important, I think, but in many respects, the discussions that took place prior to the convention, at the convention, I think pretty well determined which way Humphrey would go on the issue, period. Political events did, in the end, strongly urge him, if not compel him, to modify his position somewhat. Basically, he made the choice, I think, at least two occasions before September, not to sign off on the Johnson policy in Vietnam, period. Paragraph. Just some final reflections, because not really much happened of significance after the Salt Lake City thing on Vietnam. You know, the Vietnam issue tortured Humphrey, really made him an unhappy man, period. Like everything he did, once he threw himself into it, he was an enthusiastic advocate of the president's policy, period. He ended up, during the course of the 4 years in the vice presidency, making some outrageous statements about Vietnam in response to some similarly outrageous attacks by various people at various times on the Johnson administration, period. Humphrey has an anti-military strain in him, perhaps a pacifist strain, pretty. Generally outraged by what happens in war, what happens through military action, pretty. I think this bothered him, pretty. At the same time, I think that one of the reasons he could throw himself into a defensive American involvement in Vietnam in 1966 in particular, 65 somewhat, but 66 in particular, somewhat 67, was, you know, that the involvement wasn't cast in purely military terms. Lyndon Johnson really believed he could bring the Great Society to Asia, period. When Eric Severide, in March of 1966, following Humphrey's return from Southeast Asia, asked him about the Johnson Doctrine and about bringing the Great Society to Asia, Humphrey spoke, with great enthusiasm and
true reflection of his own views in answering affirmatively. There the populist strain in Humphrey came out. And in that respect, he shared at least one strain of Lyndon Johnson's approach to the question of American involvement in Southeast Asia. Lyndon really believed in bringing the Great Society to the underprivileged and dispossessed people of the United States. And once he got involved in Vietnam and Southeast Asia, he really believed that by harnessing American technology, American managerial skill, American military might, you could not only defeat the Viet Cong in North Vietnam, but you could bring the blessings of modern civilization to those distant and alien peoples, period. And for a while, anyway, I think Humphrey got very much carried away on that, partly because he is a populist, and partly because he has that strain of sometimes messianic humanitarianism in him. Period.